That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Hey kids, I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast you're going to love. On behalf of myself, Morgan Rector, of one of the most horrific true crime podcasts, Human Monsters, I'd like to ask you this question. Do you like to travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Fun fact, there is a morgue on every cruise ship. After all, people die everywhere. Why wouldn't they die on a cruise ship in the Bahamas? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation, and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation. Hosted by true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband, and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and what-the-fuck stories of vacations gone horribly wrong. From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff, to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater. Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, accident or murder? But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers. Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor, takeaway, and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last. If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Attention, Humo Army. I'm announcing a new venture. It is an e-magazine published by me called Misanthropology. Misanthropology is a portmanteau of misanthropy and anthropology. A misanthrope is someone who hates humanity, and anthropology is the study of mankind. This magazine catalogs humanity at its worst, save for the scantily clad alt models, who are rather lovely and will grace the covers because, well, I'm sleazy enough to resort to using sexy girls to sell magazines. The official mascot for the magazine is the White Raven. According to lore, the White Raven is shunned from Black Raven society just because it's different. Different in their case doesn't mean inferior. The White Raven is smarter and larger in stature to a Black Raven. Just like a white raven, this magazine is subversive and would not be welcome on a typical magazine rack. True crime will be featured in every issue, along with other controversial issues. Don't expect political correctness or family-friendly fare. Misanthropology is for adults only and not for the faint-hearted. You can download each issue from misanthropology.store. That is spelled MISANTHROPOLOGY.store. STORE. I didn't spell out those words because I think you're dumb. I spelled them out because some people can't spell, but that's okay. There are lots of people who can't spell, but can do other things amazingly well. With this magazine, you get a bargain. It's $5 Canadian per issue, which is cheaper than any magazine you get on the newsstand. You get a PDF, which can be viewed on any electronic device. Plus, it's longer than the average magazine. The first issue is over 240 pages long, including an article about incest that is over 200 pages. I'm all about value. Please check it out at misanthropology.store. Thank you and enjoy the show. Welcome to Human Monsters. Christopher Bernard Wilder was born on March 13, 1945, in Sydney, Australia. By all accounts, his childhood was a happy one. His parents were not abusive, and they enjoyed a comfortable middle-class existence. Trauma did rear its ugly head, however. Wilder had two near-death experiences as a child. The first happened immediately following his birth. He was born premature, and doctors did not expect him to survive. His second brush with death occurred years later when he went swimming with some friends. His friends rescued him from drowning with some assistance from a lifeguard. The experience had a profound impact on Wilder, a transformative one for his personality. Instead of valuing his life and feeling grateful for every day to be had, he became reckless, taking risks like someone who feels immortal. It was like he lived his life within a suit of armor whose solidity was impervious to the scythe of the Grim Reaper. As for the impact on his relations with others, he was noted to be lacking in empathy, especially when it came to females. Speaking of which, he developed a deviant sexual pathology, and it did not wait until his adolescence to demand expression. The early stages of such manifested when he became a peeping Tom. Neighbors saw him lurking around the block in a way that struck them as suspicious. Naturally, they would. They saw him looking in people's windows. When police caught up with him and found out he was just a boy from the same district, they merely scolded him and drove him to his family's home. Wilder's parents came to his aid and protected him from the consequences of his actions, so there was little hope that his transgressive behavior would be corrected. This incident did not represent the end of his deviant sexual behavior. No. It opened a Pandora's box. 1963, escalation. One summer day when Christopher Wilder was spending time with his friends at the beach, they all encouraged one another's aberrant sexual proclivities. It was a melting pot that threatened to boil over as they were surrounded by bikini-clad girls. Just add alcohol and stir. That's exactly what they did. The boys were on the lookout for a female with whom to copulate, and they were not concerned that the ratio of males to females might not be commensurate. They also weren't concerned about consent. Whether a girl wanted them or not, they were going to take her and do what they wanted. After looking for the perfect victim, they spotted a girl on an isolated stretch of the beach. At first, they attempted to charm their way into her panties with flattery and offers of alcohol. When that failed to entice her, they threatened her. Still unresponsive to their words, they finally took the tack of ganging up on her. Each as a link in the gang rape chain, each one patiently took his turn. Once they had all climaxed, they tossed her to the sand, as if she was of little more worth than discarded food left to the mercy of seagulls. In the aftermath of their departure, she went to the closest police station to report the incident. Wilder and his friends were a frequent presence on that beach, and as a result, they were soon identified, arrested, and prosecuted. As usual, Wilder's family rushed to offer their assistance. He needed it. He was now an adult and facing a charge that could land him in prison for several years. The prosecutors were aware of his family's constant presence in the courtroom, and it worked in his favor. He also had no criminal record. Seeing him as more stupid and foolhardy than malicious, he was sentenced to probation. Aside from the customary ways in which probation can curtail one's freedom, there was one condition that was both unavoidable and fraught in its implications. He was required to undergo electroshock treatment. Nowadays, this treatment exists, but submission to the procedure is voluntary, like when Carrie Fisher underwent the remedy for depression. All it does is deliberately induce a seizure. These days, mental health care professionals generally do not condone the use of this therapy, which is considered to be as barbaric as a lobotomy. In fact, electroshock therapy has been discredited and banned in many jurisdictions. This was not the case in the early 60s, however, and it struck the court that it was what Christopher Wilder, as a patient, needed to get his head screwed on right. It was decided Christopher Wilder would undergo electroshock therapy to stay out of prison. Though a direct cause and effect correlation has never been established in this case, speculation has it that his capacity to commit vicious acts of violence may have been catalyzed when his brain was electrocuted. Now that the electrical storm was over and the clouds had parted, Christopher Wilder, with help from his parents, endeavored to become a respectable citizen. They helped him find a job and were integral in the search for his wife. He got married in 1968, but instead of settling down into domestic bliss like his parents, the white picket fence felt like a straitjacket to him. He wasn't just the black sheep of the family. He was a wolf, and outsiders would catch a glimpse of his malice as he bared his teeth. His first wife would suffer this wrath. His sexual approach to his bride was sadistic and aggressive, so much so that it appeared that neither her pleasure nor her safety mattered, and she fled after only 1 week of matrimony. This kind of life was all wrong for Christopher Wilder. His employment history was checkered with resignations, terminations, and an unreliable on-the-job performance. The Sydney police were aware that he was a sex offender, and they kept an eye on him. These conditions became unacceptable to him, and he decided to leave Sydney. He didn't move to Melbourne or to the isolated areas of the outback where he could lurk freely. His move was more drastic. He would emigrate. He set his sights on the United States. He already had dual Australian-American citizenship due to family ties, so the process of immigration would not be as replete with the kind of setbacks with which most newcomers grapple. In 1969, he became a Florida man. He enjoyed the sunshine, beaches, and sexual opportunities that came his way. Christopher Wilder's fortunes improved markedly as he embarked on his new life in America. He profited from work and investments and enjoyed the spoils as he partied with women at bars and clubs. He bought some property with money he saved in Australia. He aimed for a high level of financial security and was getting rich. At one point, he was worth $2 million. Adjusted for inflation, that is almost $6,022. He most enjoyed spending his money on flashy cars and beautiful women, and their presence in his life was typically utilitarian and ornamental. Just because his money could attract consensual sex partners didn't mean that he wouldn't steal what he could easily buy. Wilder cut a streak of sexual violence in 1969. He approached an attractive young nurse and told her he was a professional photographer. He asked if he could take some photos for free that would serve as a portfolio to spearhead a career as a model. She agreed to participate, even going as far as to pose nude. Once he was done taking all the pictures, Wilder blackmailed her into sex by threatening to publish the photos. She refused and reported his attempt to extort her sexual participation to police. The police were unable to prosecute since they couldn't procure the photos. With the evidence lacking, they were skeptical about the woman's claim and dismissed her without laying charges. 1971, Pompano Beach. Wilder persuaded two teenage girls to pose nude for him. They reported him to police, and this time he was charged for soliciting. But they were too afraid to testify in court, so the charges were dropped. Also in 1971 was an incident where Wilder forced a teenage girl to perform oral sex on him. She refused to testify in court, and the charges were dropped. Wilder never let a little litigation stand in the way of his gratification. In fact, in some cases, he would approach multiple girls at once. Eventually, Wilder took a different tack to ensure his victims' participation. He would drug them. One such incident in 1974 involved a teenage girl. He promised to make her famous, but instead, he drugged her and raped her while she was unconscious. She went to the police afterwards and reported him. He was prosecuted, facing the most severe penalties available to an offender like him at the time. Those penalties involved probation. 1977. Christopher Wilder was charged with sexual battery after confessing to raping a 16-year-old girl he enticed into his car. He was arrested soon afterwards. It turned out she was a client's daughter. Wilder informed the court that on the day in question he was, quote, down in the dumps, and that he was remorseful for what he had done. He was evaluated by a psychologist who surmised that Wilder was not dangerous but should undergo immediate psychiatric treatment. After deliberating for 55 minutes, the jury acquitted him. 1980. Christopher Wilder appeared once again in court for a sex-related offense, another charge of sexual battery. He tricked two attractive teenage girls by convincing them he could make them famous if they posed for his camera. They agreed to participate. When Wilder finished taking photos, he raped the girl who appealed to him the most. He pled guilty to a lesser charge of attempted sexual battery, was given 5 years of probation, and was required to undergo psychiatric treatment. He attended all therapy sessions. He was the Teflon rapist. Boynton Beach, also in 1980, was the worst of Christopher Wilder's sexual assaults to that date. He forced two girls, who were 10 and 12 years old, to perform oral sex on him. They reported the incident to authorities, but Wilder was not identified as the suspect at the time. It was only years later, when Christopher Wilder appeared on television due to his crime spree, that the girls recognized him. Realizing he was in danger of doing some serious time, Christopher Wilder moved back to his family's home in Australia. After settling in Australia, Wilder's parents helped him find employment and did their utmost to motivate him to find healthy and productive uses for his spare time. It wasn't nearly as impactful as they hoped. He fell back into his usual routine of window peeping and stalking girls at the beaches. 1982. Christopher Wilder was cruising shopping malls and beaches on a warm, sunny day in search of prey. When he saw a pair of girls who were to his liking, he sold them on his promise to take free photos as part of a modeling portfolio, and they accompanied him to an isolated area. Upon their arrival, Wilder suggested that they should pose nude. They demurred. In response, Wilder threatened to kill them. Under threat of death, they posed nude, whereupon he let them go. As soon as they could, they reported the incident to the police. Wilder was soon arrested. Criminal penalties for sex crimes in Australia had escalated during Wilder's time in America. The prospect of serving a lengthy prison sentence this time around was very real. He asked his parents to pay his bail, which amounted to $350,000. Immediately after his parents freed him from jail, he returned to America. He used them as he used all his girlfriends. He had no use for people he couldn't use. Back in paradise once again, Wilder invested in land, returned to the clubs, raced cars, and went on the prowl for new victims. This was vintage Christopher Wilder. February 26, 1984. The date of the Miami Grand Prix racing event. Christopher Wilder was a participant. He finished at 17th place and received a cash prize of $400, or $1,122. Despite this paltry accomplishment, he felt cocky and gloated about it out of the sight of the drivers who pulled in from 1st to 16th place. On the second day of the event, he met 20-year-old Rosario Gonzalez. She was a part-time model. She was at the race passing out samples of aspirin on behalf of one of the race's sponsors. She went missing on February 26th. Her body was never located. Speculation among police has it that she met her demise at the hands of Christopher Wilder.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune in to Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
In a small town in Colorado, people turn to a family-run funeral home in their deepest moments of loss. Run by a mother and daughter team, the funeral home offered thoughtful services at a fair price. But there was a dark side to their business.
It was truly a house of horrors.
He said she may have dismembered him and sold parts of him.
I'm getting angry all over, a small sweat breaking out.
I'm investigative reporter Ashley Fonts, and this is the story of an unbelievable crime you've never heard of. A story of a funeral home that lured their victims in the front door only to sell their bodies out the back. From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, listen to Cover Up, Body Brokers. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
March 1984. 23-year-old Elizabeth Kenyon was a special education teacher who resided in Miami. She was remembered by family and friends as intelligent, warm, and helpful to anybody in need. She also happened to be easy on the eyes, so much so she was a finalist in the Miss Florida pageant. She was Christopher Wilder's type. They dated for a short time, but she stopped seeing him after he proposed marriage. Not only was she uncomfortable with the considerable age gap, but he was sexually abusive. She was last seen alive on March 5, 1984. Her body was never found. Her family enlisted the local media and some private investigators to find her. Her car was found at Miami International Airport, which led authorities to believe she likely went on a trip unannounced. Her family were skeptical. A reward of $50,000 was promised to anyone who could provide information regarding her whereabouts. Private detectives Ken Whitaker and his son Ken Jr. searched Elizabeth's apartment thoroughly. One item of interest was a photo album that contained pictures that had been taken recently. They observed that one man in particular was present in many of the images. They asked Elizabeth's friends and family if they recognized the man. They told the Whitakers he was Christopher Wilder. When the Whitakers were informed that Elizabeth declined his offer of marriage, they fixated on Wilder as a person of interest. After examining the area where Elizabeth lived, they spoke to some locals. Some of them told the Whitakers that they saw Elizabeth in the company of Christopher Wilder at a gas station. In the meantime, they discovered that Wilder was a womanizer and showed signs of being a sex offender. Once the detectives submitted a report of their findings to the Kenyon family, they brought the information to police. The police were skeptical and offered little assistance. Fed up with the lackadaisical response from the Miami police, the Kenyons switched gears and reported their findings to the FBI. They also contacted the media. The story was covered by the Miami Herald. Though the article didn't mention Christopher Wilder by name, it did mention the theory that he was born in Australia and the ex-boyfriend of Elizabeth who enjoyed car racing. A link between Elizabeth Kenyon's death and the disappearance of Rosario Gonzalez was proposed. Christopher Wilder may have read the article, for it was soon after its publication that he left Miami in a big hurry. When police searched Wilder's home, they were struck by how clean it was. So clean, they couldn't find his fingerprints on anything. Christopher Wilder drove along Interstate 95 to Daytona Beach, where he spent his birthday. Wilder gave himself a victim as a present. Her name was Colleen Osborne. Until 2011, her case was treated not as a murder, but as a missing person. Her remains were identified in 2011. The circumstantial evidence had it that she was A, a typical Wilder victim, and B, according to records kept by the Daytona Beach Motel, Wilder checked in on the day of her disappearance, that being March 15th. Colleen was remembered as a pretty 15-year-old who was known for her friendly and gregarious nature. Unfortunately, it's exactly the kind of personality an offender like Christopher Wilder preys upon. Details of the attack and murder are unknown. Wilder's next stop was Brevard County. He made a beeline for Merritt Square Mall. He liked young girls, and shopping malls are magnets for female teens. He walked the halls with his camera in hand as a prop to sell himself as a photographer who could make a girl famous as a model. 21-year-old Teresa Ferguson was won over by his flattery and his promise to create a professional modeling portfolio for her. That was the last time she was seen alive. March 23rd. Teresa Ferguson's corpse was found in a swamp across the way from Merritt Island in the unincorporated town of Canaveral Groves. Due to the humid weather and the damp conditions in which she was abandoned, determining the exact cause of death was a challenge throughout the autopsy. After an exhaustive and thorough examination, the coroner pronounced the cause of death as blunt force trauma with a tire iron, coupled with strangulation. Wilder fled to Jacksonville immediately after killing Teresa Ferguson. Though the FBI rarely gets involved in murder cases, they were presented with evidence of Christopher Wilder's alleged offenses, and it soon became apparent that a dangerous serial offender was on the loose. It was at that time that the possibility of a link between the Kenyon murder and the Gonzalez killing was taken seriously by law enforcement agencies. The media exposure was a big help in attracting the FBI's attention. 3 days after Wilder left Merritt Island, he drove to Tallahassee. He took up his camera and headed to Governor's Square Mall. After eliciting no interest from the first few young women and girls he approached about catalyzing their modeling careers, he succeeded in luring 19-year-old Linda Grover to the location where he planned to take the photos. Wilder's treatment of Linda Grover was remembered as being among the most vicious of his crimes against women. He started by pointing his .357 revolver at her and threatening to kill her if she didn't follow his orders. He drove her across the state line to a motel located in Georgia. While there, he subjected her to a brutal beating and rape. To add some sadistic flair, he superglued her eyes shut. This was a first. Linda managed to escape from Wilder. While he was distracted, she loosened her restraints and ran to the bathroom. She screamed and yelled until Wilder fled the room, fearing that someone would attend to her call. After Wilder left, some motel staff entered the room and found Grover battered and bloody. They contacted first responders. She was taken to a hospital where a rape kit exam was performed, and she recuperated from the trauma. Said Linda about the ordeal, "I was in the hospital for a week or something like that. I had to basically leave the country while he was still a fugitive because they were concerned about my safety. They were concerned about my family's safety." While Grover was in recovery, an FBI agent asked her to identify her assailant from a photo lineup. She recognized Christopher Wilder from among the lineup of men. As Grover recalled, "It was absolutely no doubt in my mind. I mean, I had spent hours with this person, and that's who he was. I just identified him as clearly Christopher Wilder. Transmitting a victim over state lines is a felony in the United States, so now the FBI were wholly invested in the cause of tracking down and arresting Christopher Wilder. The search wouldn't be easy. He withdrew $19,000 from his bank account, which is approximately $54,022. That way, they couldn't track him by his usage of bank branches. The FBI issued a teletype APB to all law enforcement agencies nationwide. Christopher Wilder fled Florida and cut a streak of blood across the country. The day after he assaulted Linda Grover, he arrived in Beaumont, Texas. He knew the FBI was closing in on him, but he was still determined to find a new victim. After hunting for victims at beaches and shopping malls, he redirected his attention to Lamar University. It boasted a student body of over 15,000, many of whom were attractive young females majoring in nursing. He soon learned it would not be as easy as before. The women at Lamar were both intelligent and street smart. Ultimately, their future careers negated the necessity to resort to modeling to pay the bills. So his offers of free photographic services were not nearly as enticing as they had been to his past victims. Wilder resorted to the local shopping mall to find victims. Even there, those Texas girls were too sharp for Christopher Wilder. His offer came across as more than a little seedy, and so he was rebuffed time after time. Detecting no appeal in either ending up dead in a ditch or in a pictorial in-print pornography, offering dateless men a glimpse inside their glistening genitalia, he struck out left and right. In a morbid twist of fate, Terry Walden, who rejected Wilder at Lamar, showed up at the mall. He approached her a second time, and for the second time, she avowed that her body was off limits to him. His feeling of entitlement ignited a raging furnace of anger and hostility within him. Though she was simply vigilant about her safety and boundaries, and urgently maintaining both in the presence of a scumbag like Christopher Wilder, in his world, rejection of a self-perceived, high-caliber individual like him was an outrage. Such a perspective was a product of self-delusion, but he had such a high opinion of himself, he was unable to see through the nebulae. He decided he was not going to let her get away with it. He stalked her to her car. When she opened the door, he leapt on her. He pushed her into the car and drove them to an isolated spot. There, the road to the grave was turbulent. He raped her and beat her savagely until he killed her. He dumped her corpse in a canal, stole her car, and drove out of town. When Terry Walden did not return home, her family became concerned and reported her as a missing person. The FBI searched until they found her remains on March 26th. Her car was found in the mall's parking lot. When forensic analysts located Wilder's car, they found hairs that were a match for those of Teresa Ferguson. Christopher Wilder's next stop was Oklahoma City. Immediately after checking into a motel, he drove straight to the Penn Square Mall to find a new victim. Unlike Texan girls, the young females of Oklahoma proved to be more naive. He hit pay dirt with 21-year-old Suzanne Logan, who agreed to a photo shoot. Once Wilder and Logan got settled in his car, he threatened her with a gun. Wilder drove himself and Suzanne to a motel in Newton, Kansas. He raped her with brutality throughout the evening and into the following day. Not only did he rape and beat her, but he shocked her with electrical cords. Once Wilder was finished with Logan, he deposited her in his car and drove north to Milford Lake. Suzanne was so spent and weakened by the hours of violence and rape that she couldn't bring herself to fight back or flee. Wilder brought her out of the car and stabbed her to death on the shore. Confident she was dead, he drove westward. Next stop, Colorado. Wilder registered at a motel in the town of Rifle. Having established that, he drove west to the township of Grand Junction. It was ideal for someone seeking victims for rape, torture, and murder, since there were shopping malls. In Mesa Mall, Christopher Wilder stalked the halls looking for fresh prey. 18-year-old Cheryl Bonaventura fell for his promise of fame and fortune and agreed to be photographed by him. For the next 2 days, Christopher Wilder raped and tortured Cheryl Bonaventura. His torture rituals became more elaborate and sadistic. Not only was he using the live wires to shock, but he would take knives and cut small but painful superficial wounds. Speculation has it that Wilder used Cheryl to lure other victims with the false reassurance that he wouldn't harm a woman if another woman was present. Authorities believe that Tina Marie Rosico was lured using this ruse. Witnesses had observed the trio at a restaurant in the town of Silverton. When Wilde grew tired of Cheryl, he drove her across state lines to rural Utah. There, he stabbed her to death. The FBI nearly caught up with Wilder after he used a stolen credit card to pay for the motel room in Rifle, Colorado. This was long before credit card transactions were processed digitally, so the proprietor of the motel used the so-called knuckle buster method of processing the payment. He felt the customer with whom he was dealing was a bit sketchy, so he reported the transaction to the credit card company. They alerted the FBI that the user of the card was in Rifle, though Wilder had departed long before then. Christopher Wilder's next stop was Las Vegas. Concurrently, 17 Magazine, which is like Hustler, Penthouse, Playboy, Barely Legal, Beaver Hunt, Chic, Club, Gent, Swank, High Society, Jugs, Leg Show, Score or Screw, if you were hung up on underage girls, was hosting a modeling competition at Meadows Mall. Even the girls who wouldn't win the competition would be eager to begin modeling, so his timing couldn't have been better. And the timing for the girls, of course, couldn't have been more tragic. There were scouts for periodicals and modeling agencies all over, so it was easy for a creep like Christopher Wilder to blend in, camera in hand. Michelle Korfman was a stunner, and in no need of plastic surgery or airbrushing to be presentable for a magazine's readership. She was young and ripe from a physical standpoint, but green enough to fall for Wilder's spiel. He perfected his pitch, and in no time, she was sold. Later that day, Christopher Wilder subjected Michelle Korfman to the usual tortures endured by his victims. He drove her to several locations spread out over a large area. He brutalized her for days. When her body was discovered close to a roadside rest stop in Southern California, small incisions were observed from head to toe, something akin to the death by a thousand cuts torture utilized centuries ago in China. The FBI were under more pressure than ever to find Christopher Wilder and bring him to justice. He was characterized by the agency as a, quote, brutal sexual sadist. They took the tack of turning to the media. They held a press conference to announce the manhunt to the country. Photographs of Wilder were displayed. His modus operandi was described. He became part of the notorious top 10 most wanted fugitive list. Christopher Wilder arrived in Southern California. To his disappointment, Wilder found that the girls he approached in California's shopping malls were not naive. California had been a hive of serial killer activity for years, since the early 1970s. Hitchhiking and invitations from strange men were no longer enticing to girls in California. Wilder set up a headquarters of sorts in Torrance's Del Amo Fashion Center Mall. Typical of his routine, he arrived armed with a camera and some business cards. Promises of success in show business did not elicit excitement or even optimism, because though many people moved to the state to make it in the entertainment business, they all learned the hard way that succeeding in that industry requires far more than close proximity. By that point, any woman approached by Christopher Wilder was liable to either assume he was a rapist, murderer, or a pornographer. 16-year-old Tina Marie Rosico was as cynical as any other girl Wilder approached. She was looking for a part-time job in retail and went to the mall seeking opportunities. She told Wilder in no uncertain terms that she was not interested in doing any modeling. She was hard up for money, however, and when he offered her $100, about $285.2022, she found it hard to pass up.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored. Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch unsolved mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with three murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all four deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the List podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to Seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wilder didn't seize upon Tina right away. He brought her to a desolate location and took some photos. As Tina tells it, everything was normal for the first few minutes, but then he pulled out his Python revolver. He ordered her to get back in the car. Wilder drove them down Interstate 5 to San Diego. He checked them into a motel. There, he subjected Tina to hours of malicious beatings, rapes, and myriad tortures. Sadistic as always, when he wasn't gratifying himself sexually, he would shock her with the electrical cords or cut her with his knife. Suddenly, in the middle of it, he stopped. He had turned the television on and maxed the volume so that other guests in the motel would not hear Tina screaming. A news program caught his attention. They displayed his image and identified him by name. It was inevitable that it would happen. As FBI agent Gordon McNeil put it, it's the front page headline in every newspaper in America. Every news show, every radio show is talking about Christopher Wilder and showing his picture and saying his name, Christopher Wilder. Surprisingly, Wilder decided not to slaughter Tina Rosico, as he had with most of the other girls. In fact, he established a bond with her. It was a bond that, at least in his mind, was cemented as they drove in varied directions, eventually ending up in Indiana. Rosico assisted Wilder in luring young women into his trap. In fact, she would help him ensnare two of his victims. There is a two-pronged theory regarding why she chose to help him. One theory is she came to truly empathize with him and became Bonnie to his Clyde via Stockholm Syndrome. That, or she was so afraid of being killed that she would do anything to survive in his presence. Another theory that has been proposed is called Lima Syndrome, where the perpetrator empathizes with the victims and is convinced to let them go. Either way, true crime enthusiasts familiar with the case have cast her in an unflattering light. Being 16 years old didn't exactly help her either, since she was too young to actually know how to handle such a complicated situation. One of the girls Tina lured into Wilder's trap was 16-year-old Donette Wilt. Tina met Donette when she was doing what Tina had been doing when Wilder met her, looking for a part-time job at the mall. She told Donette that her boss was the manager of a store and was hiring. They all left in the car Wilder stole from Terry Walden. Once they departed, Wilder threatened Donette with death if she did not accede to his sexual agenda. They stopped in Western New York State and checked into a motel room. After checking in, Wilder mercilessly beat and raped Donette. Tina was forced to watch. That was the latest manifestation of the psychological torture Wilder inflicted on Tina. The fact that they felt helpless against him was a torment in its own right. The FBI were notified about the disappearance of Tina Rosico. Certain details of her activities on the day in question implied that she could have been abducted by Christopher Wilder. The FBI disseminated her name and picture on television. Her mother appeared on television, begging the perpetrator to spare her daughter's life. Tina happened to see this on television and broke down in tears. Wilder also saw the broadcast. He gathered them together and brought them back out to the car. He drove them both to a spot in the country. Wilder drew Donette out of the car at gunpoint and led her into a forest nearby. He shot and stabbed her. When he walked back to the car, he looked at Tina as if she were also about to become a one-woman ecosystem as a corpse on the forest floor. Wilder thought better of it and drove them down to the main highway. Wilder was not secure in the knowledge that Donette Wilt was dead. He turned the car around to double-check. Wilder's instincts were right on the money. She did survive. What he didn't expect was that she disappeared. This threw Wilder into a tailspin. Donette lost a lot of blood, which left her in a severely weakened condition. She nevertheless managed to crawl several yards away. She tried to hoist herself up using a tree as a mobility aid, but she could not summon the strength to remain vertical. Her only means of escape depended on the goodwill of strangers. She crawled to the closest highway, where good Samaritans, shocked by her injuries, helped her into their car. Had her rescue been delayed any longer, she could very well have died from the blood loss. Christopher Wilder drove with Tina Rizzico riding shotgun to East View Mall, where he was seeking a car to steal. He promised Tina that he would release her if she helped him lure a girl into their car so that they could change cars at a rural location. The FBI had every law enforcement agency in the country looking for him, so impermanence was the only thing that would ensure his freedom, whose expiration date was surely drawing near. 33-year-old Elizabeth Dodge became Wilder's target for this operation. She did not appeal to him sexually because of her age, but she did own a car, and that was enough. Years before the terminology was coined, Wilder carjacked Dodge by pointing his gun at her and ordering her to drive according to his directions. Tina followed in Terry Walden's car. Wilder pulled over to the side of the road at an isolated rural location. Tina followed suit. Wilder told Elizabeth to get out of the car. Once she was several feet away from her car, he shot her dead. Despite the promise he made that he and Tina could go their separate ways, he ordered her to join him in Dodge's car, and they drove onwards on Interstate 90 all the way to Logan International Airport in Boston. In the airport, Christopher Wilder purchased a one-way ticket for Tina to Los Angeles. After her arrival in Los Angeles, Rizzico met with the FBI, and after reporting her experiences with Christopher Wilder, she was briefed in her own right. The next step was to change her name. Not only was Wilder still on the run, but she was anxious to avoid the media focus, not to mention vigilantes who considered her to be equally to blame for the torture and murder of Donette Wilt, as well as the execution of Elizabeth Dodge. Christopher Wilder attempted to flee to Canada. Canadians love Florida, seeing it as a Shangri-La of sorts, and it is the most popular destination for the so-called snowbirds who spend their winters there. Meeting Canadians in Florida is hardly unheard of, and Wilder did have friends and business associates in Canada that he could link up with. Canada would not have been the haven he was seeking, since there was an extradition agreement between the two countries when it came to criminals on the lam. He visited Canada several times in the past, but not when he was on the FBI's most wanted list. Unaware of the outcome of crossing the border, he took his time traversing the lengthy commute from Boston to the Canada-US border. While passing through Beverly, Massachusetts, he decided to treat himself to a new victim. His handling of the abduction of 19-year-old Carol Hilbert was rushed and sloppy. Though he pitched himself as a photographer lacking a model, it immediately became clear to Hilbert what his true intentions were. There were witnesses, and they described Wilder and his car in detail to police. The FBI were aware that he was somewhere in Massachusetts. Time to turn up the heat. He finally drove to New Hampshire so he could cross the border to Canada. Unbeknownst to him, there were posters bearing his image at every border crossing. He spoke with two state troopers, asking them if he could get through the border with something other than a driver's license. They took an interest in the car he was driving. They had been told to be on the lookout for the make, model, and color of Elizabeth Dodge's car. When they called the car into dispatch, it was confirmed as having once belonged to Elizabeth Dodge. Wilder was on foot at the time. When he noticed two other state troopers heading his way, he ran toward his car. After a struggle, Wilder produced his Colt Python. He opened fire. Only his final victim was not one of the state troopers. The last body to fall by Christopher Wilder's bullet was his own. He shot himself in the heart and died instantly. And that was that. His killing spree was over. No justice. No compensation of any kind for the survivors and the loved ones of the deceased. He enjoyed the luxury of deciding on the conditions of his demise. He was not generous enough to bestow that privilege on his victims. And that is the story of Christopher Wilder. Rape, murder, torture, unanswered questions. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.